side of the waterfall. Did I mention about the waterfall last trip? I can't remember. Anyway, I'll tell you a little bit about it. It was an enterprise in 1949, I think it was, when John Goodwin came. He was asked to, because the park had gone back somewhat then during the war, and he came in as a new person and was asked how it should be improved, you know, to get into shape and how it could be made more attractive. And he proposed, amongst a great many other things, that the water features should be exploited to their utmost, and that a fountain, a waterfall, a water wheel, and a windmill should be introduced as park features. Now, you'll understand that there is a very, very small flow of water going through here normally, and it's pretty difficult to make any impression in the waterfall when the rate of flow in the summer now is such that you could almost carry it away in bucketfuls, you know. Just that flume at the water wheel this year, now that's about 2 feet wide, 60 centimetres, I think, wide. And at one time, 2 millimetres of water, it's less than an eighth of an inch, 2 millimetres of water was going out of that. Now, that's not a very big waterfall. you could get that with you could generate that by just throwing bucketfuls of water around. So it was not very possible to do anything in a spectacular sense as far as a waterfall was concerned. The fountain, of course, overcame the problem because it just recycles water in a spectacular way, throwing the water up and letting it drop down. So you don't need a great deal of water for that. But a waterfall, normally, you need a good source of water. So it was apparent, well, John Goodwin was instrumental in the fountain being introduced, and I'd heard, you know, I'd read his proposals that there should be a waterfall. And while out at the Omata Dairy Factory, where Alex's older brother was working at one stage during university holidays, I went out to the Omata Dairy Factory to see what he was doing. It was a power cut, and so nothing was happening. And we talked about power generation then, and days gone by, and they said, oh, we used to have a water wheel driving this place. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. So I have a look at it. They took me up the back, and there was relics of an old water wheel, a big one, 12 feet in diameter, 6 feet wide. And it was just, you could hardly see anything of it. All the woodwork had just rotted away, and there was just the iron, cast iron work there. But I could see that there was enough there, all the bearings and the shafts and axle and all that were there. Oh, I thought, oh boy, we could use this at the park, you know, if we could get it rebuilt. So I got permission to retrieve what was left of the wheel, and from the bits of the wood that were underwater and hadn't rotted, we were able to make up templates, and the whole wheel was reconstructed. I'm talking about the water wheel. What am I talking about the water wheel for? Anyway, that was the knockings. Oh God, they'll shoot me. Time for being put down. Water features. Yeah. Anyway, that was the history of the water wheel. And in 1976, it was reinstated, or it was reconstructed and set in there. Well, I must have told you about that last time. Anyway, let's come to the water wheel. We go back. That was 1976. 1970, from 1966, I suppose, Fred Parker was always saying that we ought to have a waterfall in the park, because he had one in his garden on Devon Street. And Mr. Goodwin had already in the 40s proposed that there should be a waterfall here. And that year, the New Zealand Insurance, I better be careful, I think it was New Zealand Insurance, it's on the plaque over there anyway, they were looking for some commemorative feature because they were having a centennial, I think. And so they were willing to put money into the construction of a waterfall, and I think, if I'm correct, I might be wrong here, but I think Fred Parker donated the motor, a very, very powerful motor, 14 horsepower electric motor and pump. Anyway, by whatever means, that all came together, and Ian McDowell and I designed and actually physically built this waterfall. And we very deliberately made it as natural as possible so that it doesn't in itself become a feature, you know, not like most waterfalls you see there, you know, they've got some sort of artificiality about them. We made it as natural as possible, set it into the bank there and had all sorts of great fun. There was 100 tons of boulders put out there and three power poles, 335 feet or 11 metre power poles. We laid the power poles into the bank as the backbone of it, the reinforcement of it, and took reinforcing steel from those and embedded it all in concrete. There's tons and tons of concrete in there. Because how do you make a waterfall where, was it 40,000 gallons of water an hour or something? I can't remember the figures. But this great mass of water was coming down to come down. How did you sort of design things so that they're all going to go in the right places? And it was a real challenge and tremendously interesting project to be involved with.
Lovely.
And we physically put the stones all there ourselves. You know, we rolled every stone into place practically. We go, you know, we started at the bottom and put in a mass of concrete to make the basin, and then built up around these three power poles, and had big planks across. And we'd go and we'd look at where we were building, and we'd say, oh, we want one this size, you know, this shape. And we'd go out and look at it, and oh, there it is, and we'd roll it across the plank, put it in place. And we could only do three rows a day, because the concrete had to set between the rows, otherwise you get too much weight up and it would just collapse. And it was a tremendously exciting challenge.
It's just lovely.
We also incorporated into it a lot of features which are probably unique. And I can't remember whose idea it was, but when we built the outflows where the water was to flow over, well, first of all, we put the made provision for putting the light fittings in underneath them. But we realised that with the light fittings underneath, if you could get water falling down the stones just below them, you know, normally the water shoots over you, but if you could get water going down behind the lights and onto the rocks beneath, you'd get this lovely, blossoming effect as the water bounced off the rocks. And we achieved it. I mean, it's great to see that it really worked out as we wanted to. We took the direction too. We took some of the water out of sight, took it down the channel out of sight, and then it comes back in from the side as if from nowhere. And we built up a screen at the top. Now, we won't be able to hear anything if we go down there now. They just started it again. But so in one place, the water completely disappears, you know, and then comes back again. And it's wonderful. One of the great satisfactions to me was hello there. Mingling with the crowds at night and hearing their responses, and some of them actually seeing the subtleties that we tried to incorporate into it. You see, it starts off as a very tumbling mountainous stream, very violent and rough, and as it comes to the bottom, it becomes more placid. And at the bottom, it's just really a water curtain. And you'll notice that those three are not at the same level. You know, we could have just put a big platform in and just brought the water over. Again, we didn't know how much water was, what it was going to look like, how much depth of water was going to come over. But all those things we had to sort of plan in the hope that it would come right. And as I say, one of the great satisfactions was to hear people just interpret those subtleties that we'd built into it. Well, here we are standing in front of a railing which has been uprooted overnight. That's the greatest disappointment here, was to think that people would come. They came here because this was a place to enjoy, where they could have fun. And in so doing, some of them have to leave it, you know, just in a shambles.
And
yeah. And I was saddened, you know, sometimes with young people, I could usually approach them and I say, well, look, you know, what do you get out of that? What have you achieved? You know, you came up here, you must have come up here because you thought it was a great place to be, and you've just left it in such a dreadful state, you know.
Mm. Yeah.
Some of them you get to, some of them you don't.
Yeah.
This would have happened last night, yeah, because the staff would never leave it like that. The main thing with vandalism is you get straight into it and put it right, you know. Otherwise it becomes a thing to do. Yeah. I used to, investigated a lot of disturbances at night because from where we were up on the hill, we couldn't tell whether it was just fun or whether it was destructive. And I used to have to come down very often just to make sure that it was the right thing. And it's pretty dangerous approaching anybody who was drunk. But I did approach a lot of people, if I was sure that they weren't drunk, because usually if it's talked to them in those days, druggies, there was no problem. They'd just laugh. Everything was funny. And they were not aggressive at all. I never ever had any problems with people who were drugged, and I didn't have great many encounters with them, but it could be pretty funny in times of people who were drunk, you know, do stupid things then.
Yeah.
Quite destructive.
George, I must leave you now.
Yes.
But I'd like the opportunity to discuss this water wheel more.
Yes.
Much more detail, because
fine.
You're having trouble with it, I understand.
Yes. It's always given us trouble with the hubs.
Well, I think I could give you the answer to that.
Gordon, I have heard that from so many experts in the past. You please forgive me for smiling.
Yes,
but I'm happy to listen to you, yeah.
Well, another opinion.
Yeah, won't harm.
Mm.
Yeah.
And, well, I have had a lot of experience with this.
Yeah, I know that. Yeah.
As far as a water wheel is concerned, it's rather different from the marine engine.
Yes.
That I had to look after.
Yeah, yeah. One of the problems is...
I'd like the opportunity...
One of the problems we faced with it was in its factory use, in its commercial use, it would be run for a certain amount of time just when the churns were running. Then it'd be stopped, and they'd maintain it, you see, and they'd go around and tap up the wedges and that. But we couldn't do that here, and so, see, that's a ton of weight. That's a half a ton always trying to get to the bottom.
Well, I was more than that with half the bucket.
Yeah, with the loading of the water.
Water-soaked timbers,
yeah.
It all adds to it. Matter of fact, I went up to Pukiiti yesterday.
Yeah.
And scrutinise the water wheel up and the features that I think are wrong with this one are right at Pukiiti.
So
I'd like to discuss it with you.
Right, we'll sort that out sometime.
Right.
Thanks, Gordon. Thanks for coming.
Bye.
Good. Well, we'll now take a quick brisk walk up round the Poets Bridge and back to the kiosk. Well, we've just walked fairly briskly along the western side of the lake from the waterfall to the western end of the Poets Bridge, and I explained as we came along, we were walking over the Vogeltown sewer. Now, one of the great reasons for building the lake, building the dam to form the lake initially, was not so much for the beautiful effects that it would create, but it provided a swimming resource. And very early after the development of the dam, and consequently the lake, they put a swimming facility, and we're looking back now towards the tea house, and just this side of the tea house, they built a diving board and ladders so that they swam, and in early photographs taken from the bridge here or in this area back towards the kiosk and looking, of course, over towards the town, you will see a square building with a pointed roof, sloping roof, and that was actually the changing facility. Swimming became a very early development, and it's notable that Robert Clinton Hughes' sport was swimming.
Yes.
So I guess that might have influenced the early development of the dam and the lake, perhaps. Anyway, over the years, of course, there's been developments around the lake edge, and you'll see some of the early photographs of nymphs. They put a nymph out here, and you know, a statue of a woman. But it was made in plaster of Paris, so it didn't last very long. In the earliest days, they allowed people to anchor their boats, to keep their boats here for a certain charge, and that was a source of income for them, of course. And then it got a bit more sophisticated, and they realised that if they had their own boats, they could keep a continuous income and expand it by hiring out the boats. And so the boat fleet became established and is still, you know, here today. And it's rather unique in several ways. One thing is that they are real wooden clinker built boats, which are not very common these days. It's a method of building boats which is not common. And they're very old. Some of them have come off. I can't remember the history of the later ones, but you know, they had sort of the type of boats that they went out whaling in and that type of thing, I think. Not big ones, but smaller ones. There were some quite big ones here. And over the years, all sorts of different boats have been on the lake. But we had to be reasonably careful because those wooden boats are very heavy. And once they start moving through the water, if they hit a plastic boat, they just fold them up. So, you know, we couldn't upgrade boats by buying plastic ones.
No.
Because they're incompatible. You know, one of the other unique things about this is you can hire a boat down there and you can go up around the creek here, up around under the bridge here and into the top part, and you're totally out of sight of the boat keeper. You can't do that anywhere else in New Zealand. And so all sorts of mischief is carried on. And one of the great gags, if you get a few strong people, is for ramming boats, you know, ram another boat. Well, one of those wooden boats going into anything that's not strong, it's quite an impact. And one of the problems we have with ducks here, you see, is there's nowhere for ducks to get out. And people have said, well, build a little platforms for them. Well, that doesn't work very well either, because for one thing, the ducks won't use them, because there's no point in a duck getting it with its ducklings getting out here. It's just as likely to get run over by a cycle or scared by people. So they don't use ramps. And the other thing is that people would wreck the boats on the ramps. So it's, you know, one of those problems.
Yeah.
Just a little thing about the ducks and the great loss of life of ducklings here. It's in the 25 years that I worked here, I suppose the number of ducklings that survived into adulthood, I could count on my fingers over those years, and hundreds of ducklings. And the problem is that there is nowhere for them to get out onto pasture or protection. You know, I mean, you get out here and there's a dog, you see, and they're gone again. Or people even. So from one end of the lake to the other, it's fairly inhospitable as far as ducklings are concerned, fairly unfriendly, shall we say. Now what happens is the only shelter they have is up at the south end of the lake, that's up towards the mountain. That's the only place they can get out safely and get into the bush and be protected. But where do they get fed? At the north end of the lake. So for ducklings to get a feed, they've got to go all the way down the lake. Now you imagine a little duckling today going for a feed down there and having to paddle all the way up to the south end against the southerly wind, cold southerly wind. And you know, the wind is cold at this time of the year. So their chances of survival are not really very great, sadly. It's just not the right sort of place for ducklings to survive. Oh, it wouldn't work, you know. No, no. People come in there. Most people are in a park for, quarter of an hour, half an hour, and they bring their children up. And you know, if they got kids, they go to the kids' playground the end. There's not many people go. Well, they come to the bridge here, perhaps, but they don't go up any further. And you really have to take them by the arm, I think, to get them up into that area. And it's not consistent. That's the problem. It's not consistent. No, well.
Is that the same with the swans as well, George? Because they used to be black and white swans years ago.
Yeah.
Human beings are the biggest problem with swans.
Yeah. Yeah, they're so harassed by human beings. You know, when they have to mingle with the boats, and people are not always thoughtful towards them. They really have a hard time. And yeah, I mean, we finished up with one swan with an arrow right through its neck. Yep, you know, it was unbelievable. We took it to the vet, and he says, "I do not believe this." He said, "A swan's neck is so thin, and the vital, you know, the windpipe and the arteries and blood vessels going through it." He said, "For an arrow to have gone through its neck and not hit its nervous system or some other vital feature, it's unbelievable. You just have to take it out," and it was right.
But
catching the thing, of course, was another thing with an arrow through its neck. But, you know, what can you do about people like that? Well, that's only one story of many. We had a chap walk in one day. He used to go through the park quite frequently. He must have lived up in Bogletown and worked in town. And he came in and he says, "One of your bloody swans has knocked me over." And like you, we laughed. He said, "Well, look at this. Do you think I'd go around dressed like this?" And it had, you know. Swans mate for life, and their life together is really quite touching, you know. That if one of the partner dies, the others goes into real mourning, and it's a terrible thing. But anyway, they are so protective of their nest and their young. It's unbelievable. They'll tackle, you know, they're like fox terriers. They'll tackle things bigger than themselves. And they get very, very territorial about their nests. And it was funny, we had black swans and white swans. And if the black swans were nesting, the white swans would be chased. And we'd have people coming in and say, "Oh, look, you must do something about this. The black swans are chasing the white swans all over the place." If it was the other way around, you know, the other set were nesting, well, it would be reversed. The white swans would be chasing the black swans. And people come and say, "Look, you must do something about these white swans. They're being aggressive to the black swans." And we never could win that one. But what had happened is the nest had just up the lake there, close to land. And he must have been going past when the male black swan was out on land. And the swan felt threatened and attacked him, and actually knocked him over. He might have fallen over with fright, I don't know, but anyway, got the better of him. Yeah. Well, you saw those cyclists going down here. I believe it's just on this corner, this western corner of the lake, where not so very long ago a cyclist in the middle of the night came hurtling along and I think probably tried to turn onto the bridge and skidded and went into the lake there and was drowned. So that's one of the sad things. That's not the only drowning in the lake, of course. And now, as we stand and look at the bridge, it was the original bridge, and this is the second one, was donated by one of the first members of the committee, J.T. Davis. Was it J.T.? Yeah, J.T. Davis, I think. Once the lake was formed, of course, it's a long, long walk to go right round it, and he might have been a person who didn't want to walk that far so often. And they called this narrow neck here the Dardanelles for some reason. And he and his committee work said that there ought to be a bridge across there, and if he ever had the money, he'd pay for it. Well, he was a betting man, and he bet on the Auckland Cup one year, and won, I think it was £400, which I suppose was a lot of money in those days. Anyway, true to his word, he had the bridge built, and it was subsequently called the Poets' Bridge, which everybody thinks is very romantic and so on. You can imagine the Victorians, you know, sort of standing on there making up poetry, but actually the Poet was the name of the racehorse that won the race, so, you know, it was commemorating the racehorse, not the not the romantic side of it. No.
No.
And the story is funny in some ways, but it's sad because he was found drowned in the lake some years later. They're not sure whether he actually committed suicide, but he used to, he lived somewhere and went somewhere to a meal or something with somebody and didn't get home again. So that was a sad story. On the other side, yeah. All right, well, we go over to the other side and stand in the sun. It's certainly a rather inhospitable wind today. Yeah, well, this, of course, is not the first bridge. It's, it's a fairly close replica of the first bridge, but the original was in such a state that it had to be replaced about 1936, I think it was, 38. And there were a few features about the first bridge which were a little bit different. Oh yes, this is pleasanter. We're now on the eastern side of the bridge, and the sun is shining on us and warming us after that torrid time in the wind. The first bridge at one stage had a flagpole on it. And that flagpole was very important because I mentioned the fact that a bathing hut was built down there for changing, and swimming was a very important feature here. And they also used to have all sorts of regattas and what they call them, queen carnivals and that, and they decorated all the boats up. They had to do anything that would generate an income for the park committee to sustain the place. And so there was all sorts of activities went on. And they even had, in the earlier days, records of... have you ever seen where the Maori canoes, they hurdle them, they put a horizontal bar in the water just about a foot over the above water level, and the canoes come hurtling along and go over, you know, they jump over this thing that's above water level. And they had all sorts of carnivals like that. They had a fireworks carnival on the water, I think, at one stage too. Anyway, all sorts of interesting ideas to generate money. But however, the active recreational feature of the lake, principally in those days, was the swimming. But of course, you did not have mixed bathing in those days, and there were certain times set aside for ladies to swim, and the rest of the time the men had the free range. And I'm given to understand that they used to hoist a flag up on the flagpole when it was the ladies' day, and if the flag was up there, I don't know what the flag was. They wouldn't have put flannel knickers up there or something. Anyway, whatever it was supposed to indicate to men that if they saw it, they were to disappear into the wilderness. Even if they were looking, they were not to be seen to be looking. So, yeah, so it's a different social attitude, wasn't it? Now we're standing here on the eastern side of the bridge, and that Norfolk pine there at one stage, and it probably still is, was the tallest tree in the park, even taller than the Carrington pine down at the other end of the lake. You'll see it's not a very wide Norfolk pine. And the reason for that is that these pines that surround it have come down in various storms over recent years, and one came down one side in my time, and one's come down this other side more recently, and so the side branches have been clipped rather, and it's not really a typical Norfolk pine anymore, but they're quite noble trees, aren't they, with their wonderful trunks. I'm told that the missionaries were very favourable, and you'll see them all around the place at missionary stations, because they they interpreted the growth habit, the horizontal growth habit, with the cross, and they thought it was a very appropriate tree to have at mission stations because of its the developing growth at the top always looks like a cross for a stage of its life anyway. Now, before we go from here, I want to point out something that we perhaps won't look at just today, but maybe when we do the top end of the park next time, we'll start from the bridge here and go up. But just up through those remaining trees on the eastern side of the bridge here, and we're now standing at the eastern end of the bridge looking towards the boat shed, there is that rifle, the end of that rifle range I told you about when we were down at the Victoria Road end. Remember, I said there was a 400 meter rifle range. Well, it's built into that the side of that hill there, and it was put there, built up. It's man-made, you know. It's quite a big thing. We'll look at it later. It's quite a few meters long and high, and apparently, you see that's almost the firing or the sight line of the Brooklands residence from Victoria Road. It's almost in the sight line to the Brooklands house. So I suppose they were particularly keen to protect the house as well. Well, they have to have a background for these targets anyway. It was built so that the people manning the targets could go into the depression that was created in the hillside by pulling out the soil to create the, what I think they call the rifle butts. And I found a bullet when we were doing the development of that path. Do you remember Judith Walker was with us on our first walk around? Well, Don Saxton was Judith's father, and he spent a long time on Parks Committee, and I think he was chairman of it for a great many years. I better be careful what I say. I think it was 20 years. Maybe not that, but he's certainly a long-serving member of that committee. And this walk, it goes all the way from the kiosk beside us here right up to the bowl of Brooklands practically. Yeah, and yeah, there's a little commemorative plaque that records that. Looking back across the lake, we're on the eastern side, and looking back to the western side, you'll see some interesting tree development of trees. Most of you will remember when that was pines, dominant pines all along that western side. In fact, it was above us here on the eastern side too. But the pines had to be taken out in blocks, because you can't just take one pine tree out and plant around it and then take another one out. They are so destructive when they came down that you just had to take them out in blocks and replant a whole block. And that was about the year I came, 1965-66. I can't be sure, it might have been 67. We did one year this side and the next year the other side. And because the pines had proven that they were only going to be here for about, well, 50 years in total safety, 100 years in marginal safety, and then they just start to die anyway. You'll see the ones on Cannon Hill from here. Now they're dying. There's not many years probably in those. So they wanted, it was decided to put trees in that would be there for 1,000 years rather than 100. And the logical thing to do, especially with this very, very important landscape, was to introduce the natives. And so kauri trees, rimu trees, totaras and miros and so on were featured in that, with exotics scattered amongst them for short-term effect, like the aces with their autumn colours, and you can see one up there with its brilliant stems. And then there's a golden conifer in front there, just to add a little bit of interest. And for those sites, a half a plug of gelignite was put in each site and blown so that subsoil would be all shattered, and then good soil was put in, and then the kauris and the rimus were put in. And now already within, 30 years, they're skyline trees almost. And now they're magnificent specimens. The Forestry Research Institute has got them under survey because they are just growing so rapidly in that site. that it's sort of unbelievable in some ways that our native trees will grow so quickly. No, the kauri, that's another important thing. The kauri was never, it didn't extend this far south. It came to about Kawhia, which is what, 50 miles up, more than 50 miles up the coast. And it was never found here naturally. So, not surprisingly, a lot of local people planted kauris here. And the greatest density of kauris in the whole country is within the city of New Plymouth. I think it's something like 5,000 kauri trees within the city limits. And you see, we've got the big planting of several acres up in Brooklyn, on the Brooklyn's Road frontage there. And you can notice all these trees in Pukekura Park, and up behind us, up the racecourse walk, and up Horton Walk, there are kauris up there. And the Cowling Reserve is about 5 acres of pure kauris. There are thousands there, so big density of kauris in the town, or within the city limits. So you can see now that although people were very upset about the fact that the kauris came down, the pines came down, we're benefiting so much from the introduction of a wider range. The wider range of trees has brought in all sorts of different birds, different insects. Insects, and then that means bird food. So a lot of the native birds, which were not so common here up until 30, 40 years ago, now they're quite common, and pigeons breed in the park. The tuis came, they always used to come back for, migrate and come back in the spring, but you wouldn't see them in the winter. Well, we've seen them, haven't we, in the winter here. And that is because the diversity of plants is now so great that they can get food all the year round. And it was not until 1990, the year I retired, that we actually recorded young tuis in the park. We'd always seen them up to then, seen tuis, but there we knew that there were some young ones in the park. So in other words, the tuis felt that the place now had become so stable, as far as they were concerned, that they could live here. You'll notice, looking up towards the bridge and Shortland Street entrance, the pine trees. When that was the last bit of pine. This group in front of us, straight across opposite the kiosk, was taken out about 1965, and that one was not until that bit above the bridge, west of the bridge, was not taken out. A block in there, about. In the 80s, 70s maybe, 70s or 80s, I can't remember the date. But anyway, it was thought that view, that wonderful view up the lake of the mountain, was so enhanced by the height of the trees on either side that the pine trees should still dominate the skyline. So a few pines were planted up there in that Arbor Day planting of, I think it was the early 80s, so that they would go above the skyline and again feature. You see, the ones on the eastern side here are still there. They've been left. But they're the only few that are left in this place. Cannon Hill ones, because of the historical significance. And these ones south of the lake for their skyline framing of that wonderful view of the mountain. But it's only one or two of them. And these ones on the eastern side will have to come out at some stage. There's a tree just across near the base of the Shortland Street walk there. Can you see it? It's a golden Lebanon cedar. Beautiful point now. That came out of Fred Parker's garden, that tree. That was a tree he was very proud of. And he would have, there's a native pigeon just flown into the puri tree on the other side there. He had a means of getting trees into this place that others didn't, especially since he was a member of the Pukekura Park Committee in its latter stages. And that was a tree that he had in his garden, and he had to keep it pruned. It was too big for his garden. He kept it pruned, so it was a funny-looking thing. But he wanted it. He thought it would be wonderful on that site, and it's right. It's a good site for it. It'll be a big golden deodar cedar, which is a fairly uncommon tree. So that's a bit of Fred Parker. Now if we turn behind us, now we're looking at the bank here, just opposite the on the entrance to the Saxton Walk from the tea house, there's a plant that grows here that I don't know of anywhere else in the park. It's a little sundew, a native sundew. Yes, there it is there, look. And it only grows on this few metres of bank here. It's a little insect-catching plant. You see these little pads here are the leaves, but they've got sticky... it's a bit hard to prove that to you, but they are quite sticky, and they actually trap little insects and close over them, and the plant is capable of devouring the insect's body and extracting nitrogen from it. And funny little things, they have a little rosette of these through the early part. Well, they've survived. I'm always terrified that somebody will come along and do a good weed up on this bank and sort of spray herbicide at it, and they'll be gone. But they have survived through the years, and as I say, we don't know anywhere else in the whole park that that particular species exists. It's probably partly because being near the water here, the little insects. But there's quite a number of them if you hunt for them. Look, there's another one there. Some of them smaller. And they come up to about 30 centimetres, a foot high, and have a little pink flower on the top. And then they die down in sort of summer and autumn, and come up in the winter and spring. So you don't see them all of the year, certainly not towards autumn, there might be very few. But here you see, it looks as if there's some sort of herbicide or treatment being used on that. Oh yes, yeah. A limited amount, they're pretty careful as to what they do. So this is the... The racecourse walk, which goes up, not surprisingly, to the racecourse. Photographs taken in this area from the other side in the early days reveal that there was not a single tree here. You can see, in fact, there's one photograph in the kiosk there on the wall. And right up this valley, it's now called the Stainton Dell. Incidentally, I'd like to point out that the Stainton Dell is the whole of this dell, not just the top end of it where the plaque is. It really should be down here, that Stainton Dell sign, the Stainton Dell plaque. It's a little bit tricky because there are two entrances to the dell, but there were no trees in that dell at all in those days. Now, there have been various changes take place over the years. This little cutting through this bank here is a little bit of a new development. It used to come straight out of the back door of the kiosk, and straight ahead was the end of the racecourse walk. So the problem that we've always had with the public is explaining to them where the ferneries are. It's almost impossible for anywhere down here to describe where those ferneries are. And it was even worse in days gone by when this wasn't here, because it looked as if the entrances to the most significant feature of the whole park, if you like, was the backyard of the kiosk, because, you know, they have to have the cars and so on there, and it's the most unlikely entrance or entranceway to a major feature, especially in days gone by when you had no choice, because you probably have forgotten now, but there was a gent's toilet on one side there. And it was a scungy old toilet. And a lot of folk just didn't even like to walk past that. And here it was the main walkway to our wonderful fernery. So the fernery's always, in one way, suffered through being a little bit remote up there. There's some funny things happened around here. And we lived, as I said, just across the valley there. And actually at night you can hear all sorts of... You could hear these people talking from home at night. And one night I heard a breaking of glass. And I thought, oh, well, there we go again. Somebody's breaking into the kiosk. It's a pretty good target. And I called the police, and they came up on this occasion with a tracker dog. Now, in those days, the path to the eastern hillside here used to virtually come out from the back door of the tea house and go straight up it went up this ridge here, that's between those two trees there with the stepway, and it was fairly steep. And police are not supposed to let their dogs go. They're supposed to have them on a lead at all time, on a 12-foot lead. Well, the dog got the scent from this, where this glass was broken, and hurtled off up these steps. Now, it was a pretty steep incline, you know, and steps all the way up. And I think the guy sort of said, "Oh, bugger this," and he let the dog go. And suddenly it was a woof, woof, woof up the top there, and some woman screamed out. So the policeman caught up with a dog, and the dog was standing over a guy who was lying over a girl. And it all looked so innocent and embarrassing until the policeman looked at the guy, and he had blood on his hand. He'd cut his hand, and it was he who'd smashed the window to impress this girl. And I think that was somebody from a well-known family, and I don't think the case it was ever proceeded with, but a bit of an embarrassment to everybody concerned. Yeah. Oh, we could tell stories about the break-ins at this kiosk. My goodness, over the years. You get people who pick up, you notice there's nothing very movable around here, but they'd pick up one of these seats, you know, and just smash it right through desperation. Gosh. I suppose, Molly, you could tell all sorts of stories too. Another rather funny one that I recall was just before Christmas, of course. We've got, for those who are not with us and listening to this tape, we've got Molly from the kiosk here. They have to stock up a lot of food just prior to Christmas, and of course that's a logical time to break into the place and get some food out. And on this occasion, you must have had alarms, I think, by then, because in the early days there weren't alarms, and the alarms went off. And anyway, the police came up, and they caught a guy just climbing out of the window here, because he'd had to break the window in to get into the place. He was just climbing out with a haversack, very, very carefully loaded up with all sorts of wonderful food. And he'd done it very well, hadn't he? He'd sort of put all the deep-frozen hams and things in the bottom, and stacked lighter and chocolate on top of that, and cigarettes right on the top, you know, so he didn't want to crush anything. And he was just getting out of the window, so there was no question as to what he was up to. But when anything is stolen, and it was almost off the property, you see, it was proven that he'd stolen, I think, they had to make an inventory of it, and some of the stuff was deep frozen, you see. And they got in touch by their communication with their sergeant down in police headquarters, and they asked what they were to do now, and he said, "Well, we've got to make an inventory of it all, and you're going to have to bring it all down here to do it." So it was such a funny situation. The policeman had to put this haversack on. What a scare, excuse me. They hadn't brought their cars in, they'd run in from the gate. They used to do that to get in here quickly, and so that they didn't, you know, their approach was not signalled ahead by lights and that. So they'd run all the way up here. They had to carry all this gear right back down to the gate, take it down to headquarters, make a list of it, and then bring it all back. Because it was frozen stuff. Yeah. And the guy got off in the end. He was in rather poorer circumstances, I think, and they took pity on him, and I don't think he was ever charged. Do you recall that?
I can't remember actually one incident, but we are just in the last year or so actually getting $25 and $30 restitution for hundreds of dollars of things that have gone.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
Up until then, we never really got rid of
it. No, no. So, it's a lose-lose situation all the way, isn't it? They used to, you know, they'd do hundreds and hundreds of dollars worth of damage just to smash into the place and wreck frames.
Well,
they got a bit tired of it, didn't they, after a while? Because it's an easy target, you see. It's so quiet up here at night.
Little grills over every window.
Oh, yeah, even then, there's just more destruction to get in.
Yes, but the left
we better not get too involved in justice matters. Yeah, so you'll notice around the kiosk here there's been great developments over the years. This didn't, in my earliest days, it wasn't even sealed here. And Molly and her predecessors who looked after the kiosk used to get dust storms sweeping through the tea room, and but it was quite well landscaped. I was a bit hesitant about all the developments that were going to take place here because, you know, you're a bit careful about change, but I must confess that it's been done well, and once I realised how they were planning it, because that wasn't my planning, I supported it all the way. In fact, some of the things I had to modify, that landing out there, the way that this is the landing over the water in front of the kiosk, they designed it in such a way that you couldn't actually construct it. The person who obviously did it wasn't particularly wonderful about technical drawings, and the way that was to face up to the frontage here was just wouldn't work. So I had to change that. And there was another funny thing about, we wanted to do it on the cheap, but this was in the days when we didn't have access to a lot of money. I suppose they'll always say that there's never access to enough money, but we had to drive those piles into the lake bottom. And normally to drive piles in water, you have to have a pontoon, but that was going to be a very costly exercise to get a pontoon in with a pile driver on it. So Mark Wilson of AJ Cowley says, he'd done a lot of the work, not the constructional work, but whenever we wanted paths and that sort of thing done, Cowley's were often helping. And so I asked him about it, and he says, well, I think we could actually drive those with one of our buckets, you know, these backhoe type of things that they normally use for shoveling and excavating and that. He says, I reckon if we took the bucket off that and put something on it, we could ram those with that. Well, he said, if you can locate the piles in the right places, we'll give it a go. So they had the big machine up here with its arm out there and this thing on it, and they used the, that's normally used for lifting that piece of equipment, but he used it in some way where he brought it down on these piles, and it was enough to drive the piles. But it buggered his machinery. It cost him a lot of money, I think. Probably more than it would have cost us to bring a pontoon in. But anyway, he drove them. And that was the sort of things we had to do in those days. But still, under this, beneath this punga in front of us here, you will find the foundation still of the old diving board. Yeah. And the green shed was here, just where we're standing. And later they built a kiosk behind it over in, it must have been back further. And that green shed still existed in my time, but it was over behind the wisterias over there, wisteria on pergola on the other side of the kiosk. And incidentally, we're talking about the late 1960s now, under that wisteria at the far end of it was a hand cart, which in those days they used to use to collect leaves and anything they had to do around. They pulled it round in a handcart. It used to be up under there. The wisteria itself is an interesting thing to me. See that wonderful stem of that main plant there? Now, when I came here, they'd made a dreadful mistake. On the top of these supports, what are they, about 2 and a bit metres high, I suppose, they had covered it with wire netting. They'd made a ceiling, if you like, on the place with wire netting, and it was fairly fine wire netting. And over the years, there was masses of leaves had dropped on it and couldn't fall through. So they'd built up, and it was I think, the first aerial compost heap I've ever seen. And because they'd put that wire netting there, they couldn't get up to prune it. It had never been pruned for years and years. And it was about 3 metres deep. You can imagine what it is now. 3 metres deep with totally uncontrolled growth. And so you almost had to take a light with you in daytime to go in and sit under there. It was gloomy and dreadful. It had no enticement at all to anybody. And you couldn't see the flowers anyway because they were up above this great heap of vegetation and compost. So we decided that we'd have to really take the thing to pieces and start from scratch. We took 7 trailer loads of organic material away from them, piled up. That's how much vegetation. Well, of course, we finished up with just the, you see this, the arms, what would you call them, the runners, the trunks, the branches of the wisteria. We finished up with those as thick as my wrist at the end, and no growth on them at all, just long strands of stem. And we realised that, you know, it would be 2 years before we got the flowers back, but it's now, you know, quite pleasant, and they can get up and prune it every year because wisteria has to be pruned quite regularly.
That would be very, very old?
Oh, very old, yeah. It's probably about, you know, it probably again could have been in the 1880s and 1890s, probably the turn of the century, no later than that, I wouldn't think. There's two varieties. This is that's a conventional one, but it's not a particularly good clone. It doesn't have big, long racemes of flowers. And this is a double one, I think this one here, a double one, if I recall. But it's much weaker in growth. But that wonderful stem, isn't it? And so if you can imagine, that's before all this development was made here, this interesting beds and that in front. There was just a wide, open, unsealed area in front of us here, and then the backyard to the kiosk, and that was the main entrance, or main access rather, to the ferneries, yeah, and with a dingy old gents toilet in the left there. So things change, don't they? Yeah, well, you know, development, the place must change and so on, there's no question about that, but it needs to be done very, very subtly and with thought to the surroundings. This was a logical and a good development of this area, which was pretty underdeveloped in earlier times before this brickwork was put in. Because this is a functional thing, you know, it has to be here and has to be of a certain size, and so it has to have appropriate surroundings and access. So that's good. And here's another one of the old camellias looking back from the entrance to the kiosk. And under this little corner here, now this is the outflow from the lake. Remember that I said that the stream originally went down through the through what is now the hatchery lawn, and this is an artificial introduction, this outflow here, which goes underneath the pathway in front of us. On here they put the last of those bones, and you can still find them there. I think we'll go back to the kiosk down through this, follow the water course down. Remember, this is now artificial. This is what they put in when they created the dam there. And it's a nice alternative route down to the sports ground and the car park. That's Anissa sylvatica or tupelo. That's a beautiful autumn-coloured tree, and it comes from North America. It's one of the eastern states, you know, where they have such gorgeous autumn colour in the United States. It's one of the trees from that area, and it handles damp conditions. You'll notice we're down there on a low level, which is always fairly damp, and it's pretty difficult to keep grass down in this level. But here we've only walked 20 metres and we're in another world, aren't we? You know, it's fantastic, isn't it? It's a lovely enclosed area, and we did a little bit of development of it in recent times. But meandering through it is that overflow from the main lake, and we'll follow that down to the car park. You'll notice here's one of the... we're on the little bridge now, and... beside us is one of the golden weckies. This is the tree fern, unlike the marmaku. In fact, we've got about four different types of tree fern here. This is the one where the roots continue to grow throughout the whole life of the plant. And so they're increasing in diameter all the time. And the skirt of old leaves, dead leaves, hangs down and protects it from wind and dryness so that the root tips will continue to grow. And so that's building in diameter all the time. And they become quite large specimens. Now, they grow very slowly compared with the other tree ferns. And that specimen there, which is, what, 6 meters high, well, could be 100 years old. It may not be quite that, because these are very, very good conditions, but they don't grow at the rate of the black marmacue as an extreme example. That's the one there where all the leaves fall off and all the stems, with the big black stems, that's a small one. But they grow at about 30 centimeters a year and grow to... it's about a foot a year and grow to about 30 feet. So after 30 years, they're finished. The other one over here is, it used to be called Hematelia smithii. They've got another name for that. See how delicate that one is? And it keeps its old fronds as a skirt also. And it grows fairly slowly, but not as slowly as the golden weki. Then we have the ordinary weki, the one that they use for the banks and that, retaining the banks here. And you'll notice that the bases of those leaves stay on, but all the fronds fall off. So, and then we get the fourth one, which is the silver panga, you know, the silver fern, way up the back there. We've not got a good view of it, but it's silver underneath. And the bases of those stems stay, but, there's a few... old ones forming the skirt, but they don't tend to hang on. So you've got the four different types all growing in one area, and they're really quite distinctive once you get used to them. Yeah. Well, there's a little warbler giving his call up there. sometimes this little dell is used as a feature for lighting. They'll put the ultraviolet lights up. And I remember at one time when the park staff got actively engaged with the lighting displays and put on, you know, we actually did things that were added interest to it. And our effort one year was to get a whole lot of water-washed stones and paint them with fluorescent paint. And when we put them all down this stream, this little stream here, and then the electricity department put ultraviolet lights over it. And so we had a situation where all these stones of all different colours were glowing fluorescently in the water. And up on the bank here behind us, we got dead branches that looked a little bit like animals and so on, and we painted those in fluorescent with fluorescent paint also, and they put ultraviolet lights on those. And so you had the animals up at the back there and all these wonderful stones in the stream.
Somebody pushed on the trunk of the tree here, just paper.
Yeah, so it's unbelievable what happens, isn't it? I can't quite figure out what has been put on there, unless it's been something left there when they've had some sort of lighting display.